The Tragedy of Pudd'nhead Wilson. Chapter 1. Pudd'nhead wins his name. Tell the truth or trump but get the trick. Pudd'nhead Wilson's calendar. The scene of this chronicle is the town of Dawson's Landing, on the Missouri side of the Mississippi, half a day's journey, per steamboat, below St. Louis. In 1830 it was a snug little collection of modest one- and two-story frame dwellings whose whitewashed exteriors were almost concealed from sight by climbing tangles of rose vines, honeysuckles, and morning glories. Each of these pretty homes had a garden in front fenced with white palings and opulently stocked with hollyhocks, marigolds, touch-me-nots, prince's feathers and other old-fashioned flowers, while on the window sills of the houses stood wooden boxes containing moss rose plants and terracotta pots in which grew a breed of geranium whose spread of intensely red blossoms accented the prevailing pink tint of the rose-clad house front like an explosion of flame. When there was room on the ledge outside of the pots and boxes for a cat, the cat was there in sunny weather stretched at full length, asleep and blissful, with her furry belly to the sun and a paw curved over her nose. Then that house was complete, and its contentment and peace were made manifest to the world by this symbol, whose testimony is infallible. A home without a cat and a well-fed, well-petted and properly revered cat may be a perfect home, perhaps, but how can it prove title? All along the streets, on both sides, at the outer edge of the brick sidewalks, stood locust trees with trunks protected by wooden boxing, and these furnished shade for summer and a sweet fragrance in spring when the clusters of buds came forth. The main street, one block back from the river, and running parallel with it, was the sole business street. It was six blocks long, and in each block two or three brick stores three stories high towered above interjected bunches of little frame shops. Swinging signs creaked in the wind, the street's whole length. The candy-striped pole which indicates nobility proud and ancient along the palace-bordered canals of Venice, indicated merely the humble barbershop along the main street of Dawson's Landing. On a chief corner stood a lofty unpainted pole wreathed from top to bottom with tin pots and pans and cups, the chief tinmonger's noisy notice to the world, when the wind blew, that a shop was on hand for business at that corner. The hamlet's front was washed by the clear waters of the great river, its body stretched itself rearward up a gentle incline, its most rearward border fringed itself out and scattered its houses about the baseline of the hills rose high, enclosing the town in a half-moon curve, clothed with forests from foot to summit. Steamboats passed up and down every hour or so. Those belonging to the Little Cairo Line and the Little Memphis Line always stopped, the Big Orleans liners stopped for hails only, or to land passengers or freight, and this was the case also with the great flotilla of transients. These latter came out of a dozen rivers: the Illinois, the Missouri, the Upper Mississippi, the Ohio, the Monongahela, the Tennessee, the Red River, the White River, and so on, and were bound every whither and stocked with every imaginable comfort or necessity which the Mississippi's communities could want, from the frosty falls of St. Anthony down through nine climates to torrid New Orleans. Dawson's Landing was a slaveholding town, with a rich slave-worked grain and pork country back of it. The town was sleepy and comfortable and contented. It was 50 years old, and was growing slowly, very slowly, in fact, but still it was growing. The chief citizen was York Lester Driscoll, about 40 years old, judge of the county court. He was very proud of his old Virginian ancestry, and in his hospitalities and his rather formal and stately manners he kept up its traditions. He was fine and just and generous. To be a gentleman without stain or blemish was his only religion, and to it he was always faithful. He was respected, esteemed and beloved by all the community. He was well off, and was gradually adding to his store. He and his wife were very nearly happy, but not quite, for they had no children. The longing for the treasure of a child had grown stronger and stronger as the years slipped away, but the blessing never came and was never to come. With this pair lived the judge's widowed sister, Mrs. Rachel Pratt, and she also was childless, and sorrowful for that reason, and not to be comforted. The women were good and commonplace people, and did their duty and had their reward in clear consciences and the community's approbation. They were Presbyterians, the judge was a freethinker. Pembroke Howard, lawyer and bachelor, aged about 40, was another old Virginian grandee with proved descent from the first families. He was a fine, brave, majestic creature, a gentleman according to the nicest requirements of the Virginia rule, a devoted Presbyterian, an authority on the code, and a man always courteously ready to stand up before you in the field if any act or word of his had seemed doubtful or suspicious to you, and explain it with any weapon you might prefer, from bradawls to artillery. He was very popular with the people, and was the judge's dearest friend. Then there was Colonel Cecil Burley Essex, another F.V., of formidable caliber, however, with him we have no concern. Percy Northumberland Driscoll, brother to the judge, and younger than he by 5 years, was a married man, and had a children around his hearthstone, but they were attacked in detail by measles, croup and scarlet fever, and this had given the doctor a chance with his effective antediluvian methods, so the cradles were empty. He was a prosperous man, with a good head for speculations, and his fortune was growing. On the 1st of February, 1830, two boy babes were born in his house, one to him, the other to one of his slave girls, Roxana by name. Roxana was 20 years old. She was up and around the same day, with her hands full, for she was tending both babies. Mrs. Percy Driscoll died within the week. Roxy remained in charge of the children. She had her own way, for Mr. Driscoll soon absorbed himself in his speculations and left her to her own devices. In that same month of February, Dawson's Landing gained a new citizen. This was Mr. David Wilson, a young fellow of Scotch parentage. He had wandered to this remote region from his birthplace in the interior of the state of New York, to seek his fortune. He was 25 years old, college bred, and had finished a post-college course in an Eastern law school a couple of years before. He was a homely, freckled, sandy-haired young fellow, with an intelligent blue eye that had frankness and comradeship in it and a covert twinkle of a pleasant sort. But for an unfortunate remark of his, he would no doubt have entered at once upon a successful career at Dawson's Landing. But he made his fatal remark the first day he spent in the village, and it gauged him. He had just made the acquaintance of a group of citizens when an invisible dog began to yelp and snarl and howl and make himself very comprehensively disagreeable, whereupon young Wilson said, much as one who is thinking aloud, "I wish I owned half of that dog." "Why?" somebody asked. "Because I would kill my half." The group searched his face with curiosity, with anxiety even, but found no light there, no expression that they could read. They fell away from him as from something uncanny, and went into privacy to discuss him. One said, "Pears to be a fool." "Pears?" said another. "Is, I reckon you better say." "Said he wished he owned half of the dog, the idiot," said a third. "What did he reckon would become of the other half if he killed his half? Do you reckon he thought it would live?" "Why, he must have thought it, unless he is the downrightest fool in the world, because if he hadn't thought it, he would have wanted to own the whole dog, knowing that if he killed his half and the other half died, he would be responsible for that half just the same as if he had killed that half instead of his own. Don't it look that way to you, gents?" "Yes, it does. If he owned one half of the general dog, it would be so. If he owned one end of the dog and another person owned the other end, it would be so, just the same, particularly in the first case, because if you kill one half of a general dog, there ain't any man that can tell whose half it was, but if he owned one end of the dog, maybe he could kill his end of it and—" "No, he couldn't either, he couldn't and not be responsible if the other end died, which it would. In my opinion that man ain't in his right mind. In my opinion he ain't got any mind." Number three said, "Well, he's a lummox, anyway." "That's what he is," said number four, "he's a labrick, just a Simon pure labrick, if ever there was one." "Yes, sir, he's a damn fool, that's the way I put him up," said number five. "Anybody can think different that wants to, but those are my sentiments." "I'm with you, gentlemen," said number six. "Perfect jackass, yes, and it ain't going too far to say he is a puddin'head. If he ain't a puddin'head, I ain't no judge, that's all." Mr. Wilson stood elected. The incident was told all over the town, and gravely discussed by everybody. Within a week he had lost his first name, Puddinhead took its place. In time he came to be liked, and well liked too, but by that time the nickname had got well stuck on, and it stayed. That first day's verdict made him a fool, and he was not able to get it set aside, or even modified. The nickname soon ceased to carry any harsh or unfriendly feeling with it, but it held its place, and was to continue to hold its place for 20 long years. Chapter 2. Driscoll spares his slaves. Adam was but human, this explains it all. He did not want the apple for the apple's sake, he wanted it only because it was forbidden. The mistake was in not forbidding the serpent, then he would have eaten the serpent. Puddinhead Wilson's calendar. Puddinhead Wilson had a trifle of money when he arrived, and he bought a small house on the extreme western verge of the town. Between it and Judge Driscoll's house there was only a grassy yard, with a paling fence dividing the properties in the middle. He hired a small office down in the town and hung out a tin sign with these words on it: "David Wilson, attorney and counselor at law, surveying, conveyancing, etc." But his deadly remark had ruined his chance, at least in the law. No clients came. He took down his sign, after a while, and put it up on his own house with the law features knocked out of it. It offered his services now in the humble capacities of land surveyor and expert accountant. Now and then he got a job of surveying to do, and now and then a merchant got him to straighten out his books. With Scotch patience and pluck he resolved to live down his reputation and work his way into the legal field yet. Poor fellow, he could not foresee that it was going to take him such a weary long time to do it. He had a rich abundance of idle time, but it never hung heavy on his hands, for he interested himself in every new thing that was born into the universe of ideas, and studied it and experimented upon it at his house. One of his pet fads was palmistry. To another one he gave no name, neither would he explain to anybody what its purpose was, but merely said it was an amusement. In fact, he had found that his fads added to his reputation as a puddinhead, therefore he was growing chary of being too communicative about them. The fad without a name was one which dealt with people's finger marks. He carried in his coat pocket a shallow box with grooves in it, and in the grooves strips of glass 5 inches long and 3 inches wide. Along the lower edge of each strip was pasted a slip of white paper. He asked people to pass their hands through their hair, thus collecting upon them a thin coating of the natural oil, and then make a thumb mark on a glass strip, following it with the mark of the ball of each finger in succession. Under this row of faint grease prints he would write a record on the strip of white paper thus: John Smith, right hand. And add the day of the month and the year, then take Smith's left hand on another glass strip, and add name and date and the words left hand. The strips were now returned to the groove box, and took their place among what Wilson called his records. He often studied his records, examining and poring over them with absorbing interest until far into the night, but what he found there, if he found anything, he revealed to no one. Sometimes he copied on paper the involved and delicate pattern left by the ball of a finger, and then vastly enlarged it with a pantograph so that he could examine its web of curving lines with ease and convenience. One sweltering afternoon, it was the first day of July, 1830, he was at work over a set of tangled account books in his workroom, which looked westward over a stretch of vacant lots, when a conversation outside disturbed him. It was carried on in yells, which showed that the people engaged in it were not close together. "Say, Roxy, how does yo baby come on?" This from the distant voice. "Fust rate, how does you come on, Jasper?" This yell was from close by. "Oh, I's middlin', hain't got nothin' to complain of. I's gwine to come a courtin' you bimeby, Roxy. You is, you black mud cat. Yah yah yah. I got somethin' better to do den sociatin' wid niggers as black as you is. Is ol' Miss Cooper's Nancy done give you de mitten?" Roxy followed this sally with another discharge of carefree laughter. "You's jealous, Roxy, dat's what's de matter wid you. You hussy, ya ya ya. Dat's de time I got you." "Oh, yes, you got me, hain't you? Claw to goodness if dat can see to yo and strikes in, Jasper, it gwine to kill you show. If you belong to me I'd sell you down de river fo' you get too for gone. Fust time I runs across yo marster, I's gwine to tell him so." This idle and aimless jabber went on and on, both parties enjoying the friendly duel and each well satisfied with his own share of the wit exchanged for wit they considered it. Wilson stepped to the window to observe the combatants. He could not work while their chatter continued. Over in the vacant lots was Jasper, young, coal black and of magnificent build, sitting on a wheelbarrow in the pelting soon at work, supposedly, whereas he was in fact only preparing for it by taking an hour's rest before beginning. In front of Wilson's porch stood Roxy, with a local handmade baby wagon, in which sat her two charges, one at each end and facing each other. From Roxy's manner of speech, a stranger would have expected her to be black, but she was not. Only 1/16th of her was black, and that 1/16th did not show. She was of majestic form and stature, her attitudes were imposing and statuesque, and her gestures and movements distinguished by a noble and stately grace. Her complexion was very fair, with the rosy glow of vigorous health in the cheeks, her face was full of character and expression, her eyes were brown and liquid, and she had a heavy suit of fine soft hair which was also brown. But the fact was not apparent because her head was bound about with a checkered handkerchief and the hair was concealed under it. Her face was shapely, intelligent and comely, even beautiful. She had an easy, independent carriage when she was among her own caste and a high and sassy way, withal, but of course she was meek and humble enough where white people were. To all intents and purposes Roxy was as white as anybody, but the 1/16th of her which was black outvoted the other 15 parts and made her a Negro. She was a slave, and saleable as such. Her child was 31 parts white, and he, too, was a slave, and by a fiction of law and custom a Negro. He had blue eyes and flaxen curls like his white comrade, But even the father of the white child was able to tell the children apart little as he had commerce with them by their clothes, for the white babe wore a ruffled soft muslin and a coral necklace, while the other wore merely a coarse tow linen shirt which barely reached to its knees, and no jewelry. The white child's name was Thomas A. Becket Driscoll, the other's name was valet de chambre, no surname slaves hadn't the privilege. Roxana had heard that phrase somewhere, the fine sound of it had pleased her ear, and as she had supposed it was a name, she loaded it onto her darling. It soon got shorted to Chambers, of course. Wilson knew Roxy by sight, and when the duel of wit began to play out, he stepped outside to gather in a record or two. Jasper went to work energetically, at once, perceiving that his leisure was observed. Wilson inspected the children and asked. How old are they, Roxy? Both the same age, sir, 5 months. Bon de fusta February. They're handsome little chaps. One's just as handsome as the other, too. A delighted smile exposed the girl's white teeth, and she said. Bless your soul, Mr. Wilson, it's po'ful nice of you to say dat, c'est one of a main tony a nigger. Mighty prime little nigger, Ilaise says, but dat's c'est it's mine, of course. How do you tell them apart, Roxy, when they haven't any clothes on? Roxy laughed a laugh proportioned to her size, and said. Oh, I can tell them apart, Mr. Wilson, but I bet Marseille Percy couldn't. Not to save his life. Wilson chatted along for a while, and presently got Roxy's fingerprints for his collection right hand and left on a couple of his glass strips, then labeled and dated them, and took the records of both children, and labeled and dated them also. 2 months later, on the 3D of September, he took this trio of finger marks again. He liked to have a series, two or three takings at intervals during the period of childhood, these to be followed by others at intervals of several years. The next day, that is to say, on the 4th of September, something occurred which profoundly impressed Roxana. Mr. Driscoll missed another small sum of money, which is a way of saying that this was not a new thing, but had happened before. In truth, it had happened 3 times before. Driscoll's patience was exhausted. He was a fairly humane man toward slaves and other animals, he was an exceedingly humane man toward the erring of his own race. Theft he could not abide, and plainly there was a thief in his house. Necessarily the thief must be one of his negroes. Sharp measures must be taken. He called his servants before him. There were 3 of these, besides Roxy, a man, a woman, and a boy 12 years old. They were not related. Mr. Driscoll said. You have all been warned before. It has done no good. This time I will teach you a lesson. I will sell the thief. Which of you is the guilty one? They all shuddered at the threat, for here they had a good home, and a new one was likely to be a change for the worse. The denial was general. None had stolen anything, not money, anyway a little sugar, or cake, or honey, or something like that, that Marseille Percy wouldn't mind or miss, but not money, never a cent of money. They were eloquent in their protestations, but Mr. Driscoll was not moved by them. He answered each in turn with a stern name, the thief. The truth was, all were guilty but Roxana. She suspected that the others were guilty, but she did not know them to be so. She was horrified to think how near she had come to being guilty herself. She had been saved in the nick of time by a revival in the colored Methodist church, a fortnight before, at which time and place she got religion. The very next day after that gracious experience, while her change of style was fresh upon her and she was vain of her purified condition, her master left a couple dollars lying unprotected on his desk, and she happened upon that temptation when she was polishing around with a dust rag. She looked at the money a while with a steady rising resentment, then she burst out with, "Dad blamed that revival. I wished it had been put off till tomorrow." Then she covered the tempter with a book, and another member of the kitchen cabinet got it. She made this sacrifice as a matter of religious etiquette, as a thing necessary just now, but by no means to be wrested into a precedent. No, a week or two would limber up her piety, then she would be rational again, and the next $2 that got left out in the cold would find a comforter, and she could name the comforter. Was she bad? Was she worse than the general run of her race? No. They had an unfair show in the battle of life, and they held it no sin to take military advantage of the enemy in a small way, but not in a large one. They would smooch provisions from the pantry whenever they got a chance, or a brass thimble, or a cake of wax, or an emery bag, or a paper of needles, or a silver spoon, or a dollar bill, or small articles of clothing, or any other property of light value, and so far were they from considering such reprisals sinful, that they would go to church and shout and pray the loudest and sincerest with their plunder in their pockets. A farm smokehouse had to be kept heavily padlocked, For even the colored deacon himself could not resist a hand when Providence showed him in a dream, or otherwise, where such a thing hung lonesome and longed for someone to love. But with 100 hanging before him, the deacon would not take 2, that is, on the same night. On frosty nights the humane negro prowler would warm the end of a plank and put it up under the cold claws of chickens roosting in a tree, a drowsy hen would step onto the comfortable board, softly clucking her gratitude, and the prowler would dump her into his bag, and later into his stomach, perfectly sure that in taking this trifle from the man who daily robbed him of an inestimable treasure, his liberty, he was not committing any sin that God would remember against him in the last great day. Name the thief. For the fourth time Mr. Driscoll had said it, and always in the same hard tone. And now he added these words of awful import. I give you 1 minute. He took out his watch. If at the end of that time you have not confessed, I will not only sell all 4 of you, but I will sell you down the river. It was equivalent to condemning them to hell. No Missouri Negro doubted this. Roxy reeled in her tracks and the color vanished out of her face. The others dropped to their knees as if they had been shot. Tears gushed from their eyes. Their supplicating hands went up, and 3 answers came in the one instant. I done it. I done it. I done it. Have mercy, Master Lord, have mercy on us po' niggers. Very good, said the master, putting up his watch. I will sell you here, though you don't deserve it. You ought to be sold down the river. The culprits flung themselves prone, in an ecstasy of gratitude, and kissed his feet, declaring that they would never forget his goodness and never cease to pray for him as long as they lived. They were sincere, for like a god he had stretched forth his mighty hand and closed the gates of hell against them. He knew, himself, that he had done a noble and gracious thing, and was privately well pleased with his magnanimity, and that night he set the incident down in his diary, so that his son might read it in after years, and be thereby moved to deeds of gentleness and humanity himself. Chapter 3. Roxy plays a shrewd trick. Whoever has lived long enough to find out what life is, knows how deep a debt of gratitude we owe to Adam, the first great benefactor of our race. He brought death into the world. Pudd'nhead Wilson's calendar. Percy Driscoll slept well the night he saved his house minions from going down the river, but no wink of sleep visited Roxy's eyes. A profound terror had taken possession of her. Her child could grow up and be sold down the river. The thought crazed her with horror. If she dozed and lost herself for a moment, the next moment she was on her feet flying to her child's cradle to see if it was still there. Then she would gather it to her heart and pour out her love upon it in a frenzy of kisses, moaning, crying, and saying, "Dey shan't, oh, dey shan't. Yo po mammy will kill you fust." Once, when she was tucking it back in its cradle again, the other child nestled in its sleep and attracted her attention. She went and stood over it a long time communing with herself. "What has my po baby done, dad? He couldn't have yo luck. He hain't done nothing. God was good to you, why warn't he good to him? Dey can't sell you down de river. I hates yo pappy, he hain't got no heart for niggers, he hain't, anyways. I hates him, and I could kill him." She paused a while, thinking, then she burst into wild sobbings again, and turned away, saying, "Oh, I got to kill my chili, dey ain't no yother way, killin' him wouldn't save de chili from goin' down de river. Oh, I got to do it, yo po mammy's got to kill you to save you, honey." She gathered her baby to her bosom, now, and began to smother it with caresses. "Mammy's got to kill you, how can I do it? But yo mammy ain't gwine to desert you, don't cry, she gwine wid you. She gwine to kill herself too. Come along, honey, come along wid mammy, we gwine to jump into river, den to troubles of dis world is all over day. Don't sell po niggers down the river over yonder." She started toward the door, crooning to the child and hushing it. Midway she stopped, suddenly. She had caught sight of her new Sunday gown, a cheap curtain calico thing, a conflagration of gaudy colors and fantastic figures. She surveyed it wistfully, longingly. "Hain't ever wore it yet," she said, "and it's just lovely." Then she nodded her head in response to a pleasant idea, and added, "No, I ain't gwine to be fished out, wid everybody looking at me, in dismissible ol' Lindsay Woolsey." She put down the child and made the change. She looked in the glass and was astonished at her beauty. She resolved to make her death toilet perfect. She took off her handkerchief turban and dressed her glossy wealth of hair like white folks. She added some odds and ends of rather lurid ribbon and a spray of atrocious artificial flowers. Finally she threw over her shoulders a fluffy thing called a cloud in that day, which was of a blazing red complexion. Then she was ready for the tomb. She gathered up her baby once more, but when her eye fell upon its miserably short little gray linen shirt and noted the contrast between its pauper shabbiness and her own volcanic eruption of infernal splendors, her mother heart was touched, and she was ashamed. "No, Darling, mammy ain't gwine to treat you so. De angels is gwine to mire you just as much as day does yo mammy. Ain't gwine to have em puttin' de hands up fo de eyes and sayin' to David and Goliath and dem yother prophets, dat chili is dressed too indelicate fo dis place. By this time she had stripped off the shirt. Now she clothed the naked little creature in one of Thomas A. Becket's snowy long baby gowns, with its bright blue bows and dainty flummery of ruffles. Da now you's fixed. She propped the child in a chair and stood off to inspect it. Straightway her eyes began to widen with astonishment and admiration, and she clapped her hands and cried out, "Why, it do beat all. I never knowed you was so lovely. Marseille Tommy ain't a bit puttier, not a single bit." She stepped over and glanced at the other infant. She flung a glance back at her own, then one more at the heir of the house. Now a strange light dawned in her eyes, and in a moment she was lost in thought. She seemed in a trance. When she came out of it she muttered, "When I was a washin' him in de tub, yes titty, his own pappy asked me which of em was his'n." She began to move about like one in a dream. She undressed Thomas A. Becket, stripping him of everything, and put the tulinen shirt on him. She put his coral necklace on her own child's neck. Then she placed the children side by side, and after earnest inspection she muttered, "Now who would believe clothes could do to like a dat? Dog my cats if it ain't all I can do to tell t'other from which, let alone his pappy." She put her cub in Tommy's elegant cradle and said, "Use young Marseille Tom from dis out, and I got to practice and get used to memberin' to call you dat, honey, or I's gwine to make a mistake sometime and get us both into trouble. Da now you lay still and don't fret no mo', Marseille Tomo. Thank de good Lord in heaven, you's saved, you's saved. Dey ain't no man can ever sell mammy's po' little honey down de river now." She put the heir of the house in her own child's unpainted pine cradle, and said, contemplating its slumbering form uneasily, "I's sorry for you, honey, I's sorry, God knows I is, but what can I do, what could I do? Yo pappy would sell him to somebody, sometime, and den he'd go down de river, show, and I couldn't stand it." She flung herself on her bed and began to think and toss and think. By and by she sat suddenly upright, for a comforting thought had flown through her worried mind. "'Tain't no sin white folks has done it. It ain't no sin, glory to goodness it ain't no sin. Dey's done it, yes, and dey was the biggest quality in de whole bilin, two kings." She began to muse. She was trying to gather out of her memory the dim particulars of some tale she had heard some time or other. At last she said, "Now I's got it. Now I remember. It was that old nigger preacher dat told it, de time he come over here from Illinois and preached in de nigger church. He said dey ain't nobody can save his own self, can't do it by faith, can't do it by works, can't do it no way at all. Free grace is de only way, and dat don't come from nobody but Jesus de Lord, and he can give it to anybody he please, saint or sinner he don't care. He do Jesus as he's a minister. He select out anybody dat suit him, and put another one in his place, and make de fust one happy forever and leave t'other one to burn wid Satan. De preacher said it was just like dey done in England one time, long time ago. De queen she left her baby layin' her in one day, and went out callin', and one of de niggers round bout de place dat was most white, she come in and see de chili layin' her in, and tuck and put her own chili's clothes on de queen's chili, and put de queen's chili's clothes on her own chili, and den left her own chili layin' her in and tuck and toted de queen's chili home to de nigger quarter, and nobody ever found it out. And her chili was de king bimby, and sold a queen's chili down de river one time when dey had to settle up de estate. Da, now de preacher said it his own self, and it ain't no sin, CSA white folks done it. Dey done it, yes, dey done it, and not only JIS common white folks nother, but de biggest quality dey is in de whole bilin. Oh, I's so glad I remember about dat." She got up light-hearted and happy, and went to the cradles and spent what was left of the night practicing. She would give her own child a light pat and say humbly, "Lay still, Marseille Tom," then give the real Tom a pat and say with severity, "Lay still, Chambers. Does you want me to take something to you?" As she progressed with her practice, she was surprised to see how steadily and surely the awe which had kept her tongue reverent and her manner humble toward her young master was transferring itself to her speech and manner toward the usurper, and how similarly handy she was becoming in transferring her motherly curtness of speech and peremptoriness of manner to the unlucky heir of the ancient house of Driscoll. She took occasional rests from practicing, and absorbed herself in calculating her chances. "Dey'll sell des a niggers today fo' stealin' de money, den dey'll buy some mo' dat don't know de chillin', so dat's all right. When I takes de chillin' out to get de air, de minute I's round de corner I's gwine to gom dey mouths all round wid jam, den dey can nobody notice dey's changed. Yes, I gwineter do dat till I's safe, if it's a year. Day ain't but one man dat I's afeard of, and dat's dat Puddinhead Wilson. Day calls him a Puddinhead, and says he's a fool. My lan, dat man ain't no mo fool den I is. He's de smartest man in dis town, lessen it's Judge Driscoll or maybe Pem Howard. Blame dat man, he worries me wid dem ornery glasses of his, I believe he's a witch. But nemeen, I's gwine to happen around I wanna des a days and let on dat I reckon he wants to print de chillin's fingers again. And if he don't notice days changed, I bound day ain't nobody gwine to notice it, and then I's safe, show. But I reckon I'll tote along a hoss shoe to keep off de witch work. The new Negroes gave Roxy no trouble, of course. The master gave her none, for one of his speculations was in jeopardy, and his mind was so occupied that he hardly saw the children when he looked at them, and all Roxy had to do was to get them both into a gale of laughter when he came about, then their faces were mainly cavities exposing gums, and he was gone again before the spasm passed and the little creatures resumed a human aspect. Within a few days the fate of the speculation became so dubious that Mr. Percy went away with his brother the judge, to see what could be done with it. It was a land speculation as usual, and it had gotten complicated with a lawsuit. The men were gone 7 weeks. Before they got back, Roxy had paid her visit to Wilson, and was satisfied. Wilson took the fingerprints, labeled them with the names and with the date October the 1st, put them carefully away and continued his chat with Roxy, who seemed very anxious that he should admire the great advance in flesh and beauty which the babies had made since he took their fingerprints a month before. He complimented their improvement to her contentment, and as they were without any disguise of jam or other stain, she trembled all the while and was miserably frightened lest at any moment he. But he didn't. He discovered nothing, and she went home jubilant, and dropped all concern about the matter permanently out of her mind. Chapter 4. The Ways of the Changelings. Adam and Eve had many advantages, but the principal one was, that they escaped teething. Puddinhead Wilson's Calendar. There is this trouble about special providences, namely, there is so often a doubt as to which party was intended to be the beneficiary. In the case of the children, the bears and the prophet, the bears got more real satisfaction out of the episode than the prophet did, because they got the children. Puddinhead Wilson's Calendar. This history must henceforth accommodate itself to the change which Roxana has consummated, and call the real heir Chambers and the usurping little slave Thomas A. Becket, shortening this latter name to Tom, for daily use, as the people about him did. Tom was a bad baby, from the very beginning of his usurpation. He would cry for nothing, he would burst into storms of devilish temper without notice, and let go scream after scream and squall after squall, then climax the thing with holding his breath, the frightful specialty of the teething nursling, in the throes of which the creature exhausts its lungs, then is convulsed with noiseless squirmings and twistings and kickings in the effort to get its breath, while the lips turn blue and the mouth stands wide and rigid, offering for inspection one wee tooth set in the lower rim of a hoop of red gums, and when the appalling stillness has endured until one is sure the lost breath will never return, a nurse comes flying, and dashes water in the child's face, and presto! The lungs fill, and instantly discharge a shriek, or a yell, or a howl which bursts the listening ear and surprises the owner of it into saying words which would not go well with a halo if he had one. The baby Tom would claw anybody who came within reach of his nails, and pound anybody he could reach with his rattle. He would scream for water until he got it, and then throw cup and all on the floor and scream for more. He was indulged in all his caprices, howsoever troublesome and exasperating they might be. He was allowed to eat anything he wanted, particularly things that would give him the stomach ache. When he got to be old enough to begin to toddle about and say broken words and get an idea of what his hands were for, he was a more consummate pest than ever. Roxy got no rest while he was awake. He would call for anything and everything he saw, simply saying "want it." Want it, which was a command. When it was brought, he said in a frenzy, and motioning it away with his hands, "Don't want it. Don't want it." And the moment it was gone he set up frantic yells of "want it. Want it. Want it." And Roxy had to give wings to her heels to get that thing back to him again before he could get time to carry out his intention of going into convulsions about it. What he preferred above all other things was the tongs. This was because his father had forbidden him to have them lest he break windows and furniture with them. The moment Roxy's back was turned he would toddle to the presence of the tongs and say "like it," and cock his eye to one side to see if Roxy was observing, then "on it," and cock his eye again, then "have it," with another furtive glance, and finally "take it," and the prize was his. The next moment the heavy implement was raised aloft, the next, there was a crash and a squall, and the cat was off on three legs to meet an engagement. Roxy would arrive just as the lamp or a window went to irremediable smash. Tom got all the petting, Chambers got none. Tom got all the delicacies, Chambers got mush and milk, and clabber without sugar. In consequence, Tom was a sickly child and Chambers wasn't. Tom was fractious, as Roxy called it, and overbearing, Chambers was meek and docile. With all her splendid common sense and practical everyday ability, Roxy was a doting fool of a mother. She was this toward her child, and she was also more than this, by the fiction created by herself, he was become her master. The necessity of recognizing this relation outwardly and of perfecting herself in the forms required to express the recognition, had moved her to such diligence and faithfulness in practicing these forms that this exercise soon concreted itself into habit. It became automatic and unconscious, then a natural result followed. Deceptions intended solely for others gradually grew practically into self-deceptions as well. The mock reverence became real reverence, the mock obsequiousness real obsequiousness, the mock homage real homage. The little counterfeit rift of separation between imitation slave and imitation master widened and widened, and became an abyss, and a very real one, and on one side of it stood Roxy, the dupe of her own deceptions, and on the other stood her child, no longer a usurper to her, but her accepted and recognized master. He was her darling, her master, and her deity all in one, and in her worship of him she forgot who she was and what he had been. In babyhood Tom cuffed and banged and scratched Chambers unrebuked, and Chambers early learned that between meekly bearing it and resenting it, the advantage all lay with the former policy. The few times that his persecutions had moved him beyond control and made him fight back had cost him very dear at headquarters, not at the hands of Roxy, for if she ever went beyond scolding him sharply for forgetting who his young master was, she at least never extended her punishment beyond a box on the ear. No, Percy Driscoll was the person. He told Chambers that under no provocation whatever was he privileged to lift his hand against his little master. Chambers overstepped the line 3 times, and got 3 such convincing canings from the man who was his father and didn't know it, that he took Tom's cruelties in all humility after that, and made no more experiments. Outside of the house the two boys were together all through their boyhood. Chambers was strong beyond his years, and a good fighter, strong because he was coarsely fed and hard worked about the house. And a good fighter because Tom furnished him plenty of practice on white boys whom he hated and was afraid of. Chambers was his constant bodyguard, to and from school, he was present on the playground at recess to protect his charge. He fought himself into such a formidable reputation, by and by, that Tom could have changed clothes with him, and ridden in peace, like Sir Kay in Launcelot's armor. He was good at games of skill, too. Tom staked him with marbles to play keeps with, and then took all the winnings away from him. In the winter season Chambers was on hand, in Tom's worn-out clothes, with holy red mittens, and holy shoes, and pants holy at the knees and seat, to drag a sled up the hill for Tom, warmly clad, to ride down on, but he never got a ride himself. He built snowmen and snow fortifications under Tom's directions. He was Tom's patient target when Tom wanted to do some snowballing, but the target couldn't fire back. Chambers carried Tom's skates to the river and strapped them on him, then trotted around after him on the ice, so as to be on hand when wanted, but he wasn't ever asked to try.